Hello, friends. My name is Rabbi Yaakov Wolbe, and welcome to the Jewish History Podcast. In this podcast, we will try and tell the remarkable story of the Jewish people from a traditional Jewish perspective. The first five episodes will be a sweeping overview of five millennia of Jewish history, beginning with Adam and going all the way to modern times. After the first five episodes, we will begin to study and analyze Jewish history on a deeper level by discussing the major individuals, the major events, the major trends that moved the nation, beginning with the end of the Second Temple era, around 100 years before the Common Era. My email address is rabbiwolbe@gmail.com. Please don't hesitate to reach out with any comments or questions. And check out rabbiwolbe.com for my four other podcast channels. Thank you for listening and enjoy. Welcome to part one of five millennia of Jewish history in 5 weeks. This one is called Faith, Fathers, and Foundations. And I want to begin with an introduction as to why we study history in general. What's the benefit of going back in time and looking at the past? What can we learn from it today? So I think there's a few ways to answer that question. I think, first of all, with history in general, there is this idea that we've all heard that history repeats itself. If you learn about the past, it makes you more informed about the present. There's this line about history that those who fail to learn the lessons of history are doomed to repeat it. And the idea is that history is the testing ground of ideas. History is, if you want to know if something is a good idea or a bad idea, you may not have all the answers. But if it's been tried before, trial and error, if it's been tried before in history, then you have a pretty good sense of how it's going to work out in present times. Maybe 150 years ago, there was a very viable debate that we could have had as to which system of government, which kind of economy would be better for citizens. Would it be communism or capitalism? That may have been a very viable debate 150 years ago, but I think today, where we see that capitalist societies flourished and communist societies didn't, I think it's clear that the history has shown us that one is a better option than the other. That's just a broad notion of the value of studying history in general. But Jewish history in particular, I think there's a few added wrinkles. First of all, the Torah itself advises us to study our predecessors and antecedents. There's a verse in chapter 32 of Deuteronomy of Devarim. Zechor Yemos Olam, remember the days of the world. Ponder the years of every generation, ask your father, and he will tell you, and your elders, and they will speak to you. So there is actually a religious ideal from the Jewish perspective of studying history, where we're encouraged in the Torah to go back to the prophets, to our fathers, to go back to previous generations and learn about what happened. And I think that there's a special insight with respect to Jewish history as to why we should study it and why maybe it's unique in the study of history. We believe that the Jewish God is not just a creator, but a Jewish God, the Jewish definition of God is that God is overseeing, that God is sustaining the world. God is manipulating the world. We're trained as Jews to look for God's hand in history. And if you study the remarkable past that our nation has had, and you see so many areas where such improbable things happened, you can actually trace God interfering with the normal course of events the way it should have happened. And it's actually a way to come and arrive and even to deepen and sustain and nourish a faith and relationship with God, which is an interesting idea because we don't believe that God created and then divorced himself from the world. We believe that God is actively involved in our lives as individuals, but certainly actively involved with us as a nation. And therefore, when we study Jewish history, it's an exercise in faith and faith development. That's one idea of why Jewish history is unique and why the value, there's a value for us to study Jewish history. But I think even more broadly, Jewish history, of course, is the story of our nation and our people. But according to Jewish philosophy, it's also the story of the development of mankind. It's a much broader idea. It's not just the story of one small nation. You know, we're 0.2% of the world population. It's an infinitesimally small section of humanity. And we talk about the Jewish nation, what, we're 14, 15 million people. It's so small, but the impact that we have is really beyond our numbers. And once you accept the notion of an intelligent creator, you necessarily accept the idea that the creation, i.e. the world, has a purpose. Once you understand the world is finite, the world has a beginning, the world has a purpose, you also have to recognize that the world has an end. There has to be a goal. There has to be a destiny to which the world is all working towards. We talk about being God's chosen people. And of course, that can raise the ire of the anti-Semites and the people that hate Jews. You're special, you're chosen, you're better than us. And that has been a criticism of our nation for a long time, that we think we're better. But what we believe, when we say chosen people, is that we believe that we play a central role in guiding and stewarding the world to its destination. As such, when we talk about Jewish history, it has much grander ramifications for the world at large, because our history actually mirrors the trajectory of the destiny of all of mankind. I want to just develop this idea because I really think it lays the foundation for Jewish history and really world history and human development more broadly. I want to expand this idea with an intriguing statement from the Talmud. The Talmud tells us in the Book of Sanhedrin, on page 97a, that they taught in the Academy of Elijah. 6,000 years is the world. 2,000 years of Tohu, which means emptiness or chaos or desolation. 2,000 years of Torah and 2,000 years of Mashiach, of Messiah. So if you ever heard the idea of a 6,000-year world in the Jewish calendar, this is where it comes from. But it's very intriguing. It's a 6,000-year is the world. That's it. It begins with Adam and it ends around the year 6,000. It's a very interesting idea where we look at we think of history as just being retroactive, looking backwards, hindsight. But really, from the Jewish perspective, it's a process and a development that's reaching a certain goal. And when you understand what this goal, what are these three epochs, these three blocks of 2,000 years? There's 2,000 years of Tohu, and 2,000 years of Torah, and 2,000 years of Messiah. And you kind of zoom out and see what has happened and how the world has changed in these eras. You actually get a sense of what we believe our role is as a nation. So what does this mean? What is this framework for understanding Jewish history and understanding the role and the destiny of the Jewish nation? So of course, the 6,000 years begin with Adam. And this is an important point. If you study science about the age of the universe, the number is somewhere between 13.8 and 15.4 billion years. We're talking about a 6,000-year world. Right now, we're in the year 5778 of that. And the easiest way to reconcile this apparent contradiction is by saying that the Jewish calendar is not about the age of the universe. It's the age of the world vis-a-vis mankind since Adam. And you look at the Torah gives us very scant details about everything that happened before Adam. You get like about 20 sentences. It's really not comprehensive. And the reason why is because what's important to us, and that's why our calendar actually begins with this juncture, is Adam and Adam and Adam's conflict and the result of Adam's activity. And everything that happens to humanity is all an outgrowth of that beginning, that starting point of the story. And during these first 2,000 years, we're told it's tohu, it's emptiness, it's desolation. And the reason why is because the idea of God is not present in the world. In fact, if you read this between the lines of the story of Genesis, you'll notice that the whole episode of Adam in the Garden of Eden, it's all setting the stage for the underlying problem in the world. Adam, what he did and what happened to him, it changed his physiology and removed God from his purview. And everything that happens to us and the whole history of humanity and the role that we play in it is all a result of that. Thus, you look at Adam. He was told not to eat from a certain tree, the tree of knowledge of good and evil. He's also told that when you eat from the tree, he'll become someone who knows both good and evil. And then what happens? He eats from the tree and he knows good and evil. What this actually means is that Adam did not have any internal forces that were in opposition to God before his sin. Internally, he only had good motivators. The only bad motivator was the serpent in the Garden of Eden story, which was external to him. Internally, there was only one force. It was only his soul, and it was only God. What happens? Adam voluntarily chooses to change the world history. And he consumes from the fruit of the tree of knowledge, good and bad. And from then on, he knows, i.e. internally from within, both good and bad have a say. And as a result, God is removed from his purview. The good is not exclusive internally. And that creates the fundamental problem in our world. And the Talmud gives us a very interesting illustration of this. The Talmud says, maybe this sounds a little surprising, the Talmud says that Adam was created circumcised. But he chose to reverse his circumcision, to undo it, to do a circumcision reversal surgery. That's what the Talmud says. Very strange little anecdote, little factoid that maybe we didn't think that we needed to know. But what this actually means is that the circumcision, that is a representation of exposing God in the world. In fact, the Talmud says that there's something called the Yetzer Hara, the evil inclination, and that is equivalent to being uncircumcised. So what it means is that Adam had clarity. Initially, he knew about God was not something that was external, that was not unknown to him. He was very keenly and intimately connected to the idea of God. He chose to bring the lack of clarity into the world, thus he reversed, so to speak, his clarity, his circumcision reversal surgery, and thus he brought chaos. He brought lack of understanding. He brought desolation and emptiness to the world. And once that happens, man begins to forget God. And the world is fundamentally broken. You know, the only ultimate truth that exists is obscured. God is not known to all. When we look at world history, we look at the role, why do we exist? It's an important question that we should ask. It's the second theological question that every thinking person should ask. First question is, okay, who's in charge? Once it's established that God is in charge, the next question is, okay, what's the purpose? What's the role of mankind? In a nutshell, what we say is that the role of mankind is to undo the reality brought about by Adam's sin, to undo the fact that God is obscure from the world. If you've ever heard the term tikkun olam, fixing the world, this is what this means. Adam broke the world because the world was fine. It was perfect. God was ever present. God was undeniable. And then he changed it. He broke the world. And now we have to deal with the aftermath of his decision, and we have to try to undo it. These 6,000 years is a story from Adam causing the emptiness and the chaos. And the next two eras, the 2,000 years of Torah and the 2,000 years of Messiah are the two steps of fixing what Adam broke. The first era is the era of Torah. Torah is where there's a nation and a people and an ideal, a mission, a movement to bring God into the world. And to at least within this nation, within this insular body, to have the idea of God present, to undo what Adam did for this nation. That's the middle 2,000 years of Torah. The last 2,000 years of Messiah, that refers to universality of that knowledge, where the idea of God is not limited to one nation or one people. Rather, it becomes ubiquitous. The entire world, every person, every being will know and attest that God is the dominant King of Kings, the total power over all. Messiah is when the idea of the knowledge of God, when the knowledge of God has permeated the entirety of the world and the actions of Adam have been undone. And we read, so Adam begins our story and he messes everything up for all of us and things head south and devolve further. After Adam, we read about the story of the flood and how the world devolved further into darkness, into chaos. There's the flood in the time of Noah. Soon afterwards, there's the dispersion, and things appear kind of bleak. Who is going to be the one to change the trajectory of humanity? And in the beginning of Genesis, chapter 12, we meet a bright beacon of light who's going to change the world. 1948 years after Adam, Abraham is born in Mesopotamia, and he has some very important qualities. He's a thinking person. He's curious. He has a brilliant and innovative, incisive mind. Also, he's very independent, and he's willing to go against the grain. He's willing to go against the flow. And he's a dissenter, doesn't follow the ways of idolatry. He's an iconoclast who pursued truth even against conventional wisdom, and using his own intellect and his own critical thinking skills and his own reason, Abraham, he rediscovers the idea of God, and he accepts God's dominion. And in the world of emptiness, there's this one bright beacon of light that's going to begin the process of changing everything. Back to the illustration of Adam, Abraham is the one who personally removes the idea of the uncircumcision or the lack of circumcision of Adam and reverses it personally to the way it was prior. And of course, it's no surprise that Abraham is given a certain mitzvah, the mitzvah of circumcision, because he personally was able to achieve the idea of removing the disruptors from God from himself. Therefore, he is given the mitzvah that symbolizes that. A dose of clarity has begun to combat the darkness. And he begins to disseminate his message. He organizes a movement. He goes from town to town preaching. He's debating. And he has crystal clear logic. And he's amassing tens of thousands of followers. And he begins the process of trying to achieve tikkun olam. And he faces death threats and assassination attempts. But he forges ahead regardless. And though, of course, if you read the story, Abraham does not manage to complete the mission of Tikkun Olam, but he makes it his own. And he takes the responsibility of being the one who is going to headline the effort to do it. And as a result, God tells him, your children will be mine. They'll be my nation. They'll have my land. They'll have my Torah. They'll be my people. They'll be an eternal nation because they will be there all the way to the very end to see the completion of what you began. And since then, we've been the chosen people. And that's just not a term that we say we're better. We're chosen for a specific reason. And we're chosen by God to achieve what our forebearer Abraham had begun. We're chosen for the mission of fulfilling the Abrahamic destiny of bringing God into the world. We're the ones who are going to be the forces to bring, to be the nation of Torah in the middle 2,000 year period, and to be the forces, the primary forces, to bring about Messiah, to bring the world to universal acceptance of the Abrahamic principle established many, many hundreds of years ago. Abraham himself is given 10 tests, which complete the total eradication of any foreign influences of anything beyond God. And the movement blossoms. And we read about it in Genesis. There's a whole nation that he has with him that following him along. But sadly, the movement flounders. And achieving the world's crucial Abrahamic mission is not going to be seamless. The thousands of Abraham's followers are gone from our history. And even Abraham's own children. Not all of them are conducive to maintaining his stature. He has a son, Ishmael. He's not a good candidate to faithfully uphold the Abrahamic mission. His son, Isaac, is. But even Isaac has also another son, Esau, or Esav, who went a bit off. Now, it is incidental, maybe it's not, that Ishmael and Esau and Esav, the two other sons, so to speak, the son and grandson of Abraham, that are not going to be the chosen people, but they too will be contributors in the religions that they will spawn. Ishmael, of course, is going to be the father of the Muslims, and Esau and Edom is the father of Rome, which eventually merged with Christianity. And thus, Abraham's other kids are also going to be contributors towards bringing the idea of God to the masses, to the billions. But for the chosen people, the third time's the charm. All of Jacob's children will be righteous and will comprise the tribes of the nation. This is going to be a pattern we're going to see throughout Jewish history, that it's not always going to work out perfectly the first time around. We have the first time the Jewish people get to Israel, and they're exiled. And the second time, and they're exiled again. And we hope that maybe right now we're in the midst of the third time, which is going to be the one that is going to be permanent. And we had the first temple, and that was destroyed by the Babylonians. And we had the second temple, and that was razed to the ground by the Romans. And we hope someday to be witnesses to the building of a permanent temple that will last forever. Now, our history, and we see this already in Genesis, is not going to be seamless or easy. We're going to face lots of hardship and lots of exile. Even with Abraham, Abraham's told there's a condition. Your children are going to be the chosen people, but they're going to be in a foreign land for 400 years. And it's interesting. Chapter 15 of Genesis, it tells us, God tells Abraham two things. Yes, your children are going to be my people, but you should surely know that your children are going to be foreigners in a foreign land, and they're going to be enslaved for 400 years. It seems like what we're told already in the very early nascent stages of our nation, that part and parcel of being God's chosen people, of having this responsibility, is the fact that we're going to be in exile and we're going to be wandering. We're not going to have stability. In addition, we're also told that everything that happened to our forebears, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, will happen to their descendants, to us. Thus, when we read Genesis, it's not just the events of the past, it's the events of the past, but that have repeated themselves again and again throughout our history. So Abraham is told his children will be foreigners. Now, why is it necessary for us to be foreigners in a foreign land, in Egypt, but then in various other places? So that's a good question, because it's one of the strange realities of our history is that we're the wandering Jews. We don't seem to settle down for that long before we have to pack our bags and move elsewhere. So there's two answers, maybe there's more than two answers, but two answers I want to offer that seem to dovetail with the theme of Jewish history and the chosen people. Number one, if we're going to affect the world, if we're going to bring the world to its perfection, if we're going to be the beacons of morality and the purveyors of faith to the world, we're going to have exposure to the world. If we stay cloistered on some island somewhere and we never get to interact with other nations, how are we going to spread our messages? And thus, necessarily, if we're going to be the ones to bring Abraham's ideals to everyone, we're going to be frequent flyers, an itinerant nation. That's number one. Number two, to be the nation that embodies the absolute acme of human accomplishment, to be a perfect nation, to be a kingdom of priests and a holy nation, we have to begin to assemble within ourselves the qualities of all nations. We have to be a nation that is able to integrate within ourselves the character, the good character, and the good qualities of everyone, of all the nations. And thus, Jewish history can be perhaps presented as a huge trip throughout the world. In each station, we're collecting the good characteristic of the nation that we're interacting with. We spend several hundred years in that place. We acquire their good qualities. We add it to the catalog of good qualities we already have. Once we've integrated that, we move on to the next place. And we pick up their quality. The idea is, the end game is that we become this kingdom of priests and holy nation where we have all the good characteristics within us. But certainly we could say that Jewish history is not going to be necessarily very easy. There's going to be a story of struggle and of unending challenges until a final conclusion and completion. And this already is evident in the story of Jacob and Esau. Jacob is going to be renamed Israel because he is going to be, more than any one of the forebears, he is going to be the microcosm of the Israelite nation, of the Jewish nation. And already in utero, he's having these cosmic struggles. He is bound with this twin that is an entirely opposite in character and behavior and ideals and values and priorities, and they're going to be quarreling their whole life. And it seems like, if you read the story, Esau has a head start. He's born first, and he's strong, and he's developed. And what does Jacob do right when they're born? Jacob grabs onto his heels. And that is, again, illustrative of Jewish history, where it's going to seem like Esau, like the other side, is going to be winning. And at the very last second, Jacob, Israel, is going to snatch victory from the jaws of defeat and win in improbable fashion. Jacob is going to live a very uncomfortable and conflicted life. First thing we're told about him as an adult, he wants to sit in a tent and study. He wants to be left alone. He doesn't want to be bothered. He doesn't want to deal with Esau. But God is going to force him to have these interactions and these encounters and these clashes with all these kinds of people that he doesn't want to deal with. So first, he's going to have to navigate and engage and outwit his brother, Esau. And then he's going to have to contend with the wily and deceitful Lavan, who's going to do all kinds of chicanerous tricks on him. He's going to swap the wives. He's going to renege on agreements. He's going to change the terms of their deal 100 times. Jacob has to flee from his own family. And when he flees from one antagonist, he has to encounter another one who is dead set on killing him. And he has to manage a burgeoning family of multiple wives and many strong-minded and challenging and precocious children. And even after he finishes navigating the minefields of Laban and Esau, he never has a respite. He doesn't have time to settle down. There's this intra-family hostility towards four of his sons and towards Joseph. Reuben, his oldest son, seems to commit a very grievous blunder unworthy of the sons of Jacob. Shimon and Levi, they seem to be following Esau's ideology. They start slaughtering a whole town because they offended the family. Yehuda, the next son, the fourth son, he's demoted from his stature, and he has a very tumultuous family life. Joseph is kidnapped. Jacob thinks he's dead. It seems like this family, this dream of fulfilling the Abrahamic destiny, is spiraling out of control. And of course, more troubles befall him. There's famine. Shimon is taken prisoner by a foreign leader. Benjamin is his last hope. Benjamin's taken away from him. If you were an outsider looking at this and had to prognosticate what's happening with Jacob's family, it's very doubtful that this is all going to come together. And ultimately, the end of Jacob's life and the end of the book of Genesis, all his children are united. He is assured that they're all righteous, and he thanks God for that. Again, Jacob is called Israel because he's going to symbolize what's going to happen in our history. All the things seem to be spiraling out of control very fast. But at the very end, things are going to come back together. And the book of Exodus begins when the man, we started with one man, Abraham, he tries to spawn a movement and it sputters. and the movement coalesces behind his family, specifically Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And the family is starting to grow very fast. It becomes a tribe. In the book of Exodus, the tribe becomes a nation. But again, as is present in every development of Jewish history, it's not easy. There's going to be enslavement, both physically and spiritually. And the people are going to forget their role and their destiny and their responsibility and what they stand for. And they're going to become slaves to Pharaoh. And they begin to lose hope of salvation. They lose the ability to imagine themselves as anything but slaves for Pharaoh. Once again, it looks like the nation will not fulfill its destiny. And an unusual leader rises to save the Jewish nation, which is another theme we're going to see again and again throughout Jewish history, is that you never know where the salvation is going to come from. And when it does come from, you look back at it, it seems like that would have been the most unlikely of places to look. Moshe, he's emblematic of great Jewish leaders. He doesn't look like a prototypical leader. He's very reluctant to lead. He's exceedingly humble. He has a speech impediment. He's not a dynamic orator. And he grew up in the house of Pharaoh. He could be charged as being a traitor to his nation. He was raised in the lap of luxury while everyone else was slaving away for Pharaoh. He's one of them. He's an imposter. And that's the trend of transformative Jewish leaders. People who dramatically impact the nation are not necessarily the ones who you appoint and would say, this is a cookie-cutter example of a Jewish leader. Moshe, of course, is a great example of that. Who named him? His name is even given to him by his Egyptian stepmother. How is this the person to leave us out of Egypt? You wouldn't have imagined that that would be the case. And what do you see again? What's the next great Jewish leader that fits this bill? King David. His own family didn't think he was qualified to be the king, much less anyone else. Rabbi Akiva. He's an ignorant shepherd. And he's to be the one to lead the Jewish people to the Renaissance after the Second Temple is destroyed. I would even argue, of course not on the same level, but Theodore Herzl. He's someone who, when posed with the problem, the Jewish problem, what do we do with the Jews in Europe? They're suffering so much anti-Semitism. His solution was, at least in 1890, let's have mass conversion to Christianity. And he was someone who didn't circumcise his own child or give him a bar mitzvah, couldn't speak Hebrew, knew nothing about Torah, about Jewish history, nothing. Such a person is going to be at the forefront, at the vanguard of leading the Jews back to Zion, back to Israel? It seems very improbable. And of course, Herzl, he's a great Jewish leader, but his credentials as a Jew, as a believing Jew, as an observant Jew, are somewhat suspect, of course. But looking back at history today, the fact that there's 6 million Jews living in Israel, thanks to a movement, primarily thanks to a movement, began, kickstarted by Herzl, I think, again, it's another example of this phenomenon. So what happens? Moshe, he travels on a donkey to save the people. There's an interesting teaching in Rashi, in the book of Exodus, about Moshe's donkey. And what it does is it connects these three eras. It says that Abraham traveled on a donkey, and Moshe traveled on a donkey, and the Messiah is also going to travel on a donkey. Moreover, this same donkey is the same one. It's the same donkey. There's this really ancient donkey that we're waiting for Messiah to ride on. That's what Rashi tells us. It seems like a very strange teaching. And it doesn't seem to be a very pertinent lesson. Like, why are we told about the transportation choices of Abraham and Moshe and Messiah? But what we do know is that Abraham, he's the one who ends the era of chaos, the first 2,000 years. Moshe, of course, gives us the Torah, the second 2,000 years of Torah. And Messiah is the one who brings the world to completion. So these three individuals are the three most important individuals in all of human history, and in Jewish history. And we're told this interesting idea that they all travel on a donkey. So the deeper understanding is that what is the problem we're trying to address? Like, what is the foundational linchpin of history? Like, what is this lever that we're trying to pull to change? What is this transformation? And the answer is, well, it goes all the way back to Adam. Adam brought the idea of physicality, being independent of God into the world. In Jewish philosophy, in Jewish literature, the idea of a donkey, even the word donkey, chamor, is related to the word chomer, which means physicality. We're told that Abraham traveled on a donkey. What this means is that Abraham was the one who had the reins of his physicality. He wasn't subject to the donkey, so to speak. He rode the donkey. He was monitoring and overseeing his physicality. He was the one who brought God into the world independently within himself. Him, and therefore he's the character that represents the transformation from the first to the second era, epics of world history. Moshe, of course, is going to give us Torah. And he also rides the donkey. He's also resisting and repulsing this force that Adam brought to the world. And the third individual of this triumvirate is, of course, Messiah, and he's going to have that same characteristic on a universal scale. Now, the entire story of the Exodus is the basis of our religion and our faith. When we read about the miracles that happened, well, what we're actually reading on a theological and religious level is the building blocks and the foundations of our nation. All the miracles that transpired, they deepened our nation's connection with God. We have these 10 plagues, and what do they show? They show God's dominion over every aspect of the world, and the providence and the oversight and the intervention that he has in the world. We see God splits the sea. We're surrounded by our enemies. God loves us. God responds to our prayers. And God saves us. Of course, the most significant event of all time is the foundational event of our nation and of our religion, and the one that's unparalleled in the annals of all of human history, and that is the national revelation by God at Sinai, where God speaks to an entire nation. And that, of course, proves to everyone, without a doubt, everyone who witnessed that event, that Moshe is a legitimate prophet, and that he communicates the unadulterated word of God. Thus, it's verified that Moshe is a true prophet, and therefore the Torah can be given through him, because everyone knows he is not a charlatan. And for 40 years, for the duration from the middle of the book of Exodus to the end of the Torah, it's only 40 years, and it's the time where the era of Torah, 2,000 years of Torah, is getting its start. Jewish people spent an entire year at Mount Sinai. The first week is the revelation. What do they do for the rest of the time? They're studying Torah. They're learning the tools to be the people, to be the chosen nation. What do you need to be the nation that brings God into the world? These are the rules. It's called the Torah. Moshe is taught by God, and he conveys the message to the Jewish people, and the nation flourishes. Of course, every time the nation flourishes, it has its pitfalls. First, you have the golden calf. There's various complaints. They don't like the manna. They don't like the meat. They want to go back to Egypt. There's the rebellion of Korach. There's the disaster of the spies. There's the episodes of Moab and Bilam. But for the majority of the time, the nation is living on a supernatural status. They're eating the magical manna from heaven. It fell every day. Parachute food for you and your family from God. They're drinking water out of a rock. Their clothing grows with these old verses of the Torah. They're surrounded by topography flattening clouds by day and pillars of fire at night. And they have Moshe. Moshe is in constant communication with God. The nation is developing and maturing under Moshe's leadership. And of course, the Jewish people are insular. Their messages are not being beamed to the rest of the world. They have to grow internally. But their impact on the world stage is very negligible at this time. The era of Messiah, the last 2,000 years, is where the ideas that we've harbored for the middle 2 years, they go on a broader scale and they disseminate outwardly. But for the middle 2,000 years, the struggle will be about the nation, a nation alone, maintaining ideas that are very distant from the conventional wisdom in the world at the time. Can they maintain their spiritual stature, and can they deepen and develop their relationship with God to be the chosen people? When Moshe was alive, there's ever-present miracles. Doing that was comparatively easy. Of course, there were missteps, but all were quickly corrected. They nipped it in the bud. The greatest challenge, of course, is going to be after Moshe dies. Moshe's going to die. Spoiler alert if you haven't finished the Torah. And they're going to enter Israel. And immediately, all the miracles are going to stop. And they're going to have to contend living as a nation. They've been primed for 40 years for this, to live as a nation under the circumstances of any nation, surrounded by enemies, having to engage in war and conquest and division of the land. Can they maintain their stature? Can they withstand without Moshe? And if we kind of zoom out again and look at the Torah holistically, the Torah begins with Adam, and it ends with Moshe. And we see, again, within the Torah itself, the same pattern of Jewish history and of world history. After all, man in Jewish literature is called Olam Katan, a small world. So if you have the big world that's broken that we need to fix, there's also a small world that's also broken that we also need to fix. Because just like God is not present in the world at large, within ourselves, the small child, they don't know anything about God. God is totally invisible. In fact, one of the definitions the Talmud gives us about God is that God sees but is unseen. And therefore, people were fundamentally broken. And the objective of mankind is to make ourselves from Adam, from being broken, from the beginning of the Torah, and take the Torah and become as much as we can like Moshe, someone who actually changed themselves and fixed themselves and undid the problem that is underlying the entire world. And Moshe, of course, is representative of the world as an individual, of course, in its total completion. He is someone who has a soul, only a soul within, and he managed to excise from himself the Yetzirah, the force of evil. Adam, he began to know both good and evil. Moshe, at the end of his life, at the end of the Torah, is someone who knew only good from within. And we're told Moshe was able to communicate directly with God, unlike all the other prophets. There was no proxy. He didn't have any fear or trepidation when he prophesied. He could summon, unlike all the other prophets, he could summon prophecy whenever he wanted. All the other prophets had to wait. God wants to talk to them, great. Otherwise, they have to just sit and wait. And as such, we look at the Torah, the story of the Torah, as a microcosm of the journey of Jewish history. It begins with Adam, and he brings in the world of desolation, the world of emptiness. And that seems to devolve until Abraham comes. And Abraham begins the process of renewal. And, of course, that's brought to its culmination with Moshe, the greatest man that ever lived. Someone who the knowledge of God permeates his entirety. Moshe's small world was entirely fixed. And that's indeed the story of Torah. And that is the framework and the roadmap for Jewish history and world history. We are right now in the throes of 2,000 years of Messiah. And if you think about it, just look back in history. 2,000 years ago, we were total outliers with our theological and religious ideas. The Romans, very sophisticated people, but according to the Roman historian Deo Cassius, they had in excess of 30,000 gods. Every nation that they would conquer, they just adopt their gods. That idea is gone from the world stage. 2,000 years ago, we were the exotic religion. We were the ones who had these radical ideas that were so out there. But today, the vast majority of the world already accepts what we believe, or a close enough version of what we believe, as true. And it's incredible. And we see 2,000 years ago, the Talmud's written that, and it's forecasted, there's 2,000 years of Messiah. There's 2,000 years when the Jewish idea is going to explode and affect the world around them. And Maimonides writes that the implements to do that are Abraham's other children. There's going to be in Arabia and in Africa and half of Spain, Islam is going to burgeon and monotheism is going to take over what was previously pagan Bedouins and tribes. And Christianity, so whether or not Christianity is monotheism or not, it's, yes, yeah, so that's a debate we could have. And of course, we've had our issues with the Christians over the centuries. And of course, we'll talk about that in Jewish history. But certainly from a theological perspective, even if you believe in three gods, it's a lot closer to one than 30,000. And thus, the past 2,000 years are a process of Messiah of trying to achieve universality of the Abrahamic principles. In the story of the five millennia of Jewish history, Moshe is going to die at the end of the Torah. The very last event, last episode of the Torah is Moshe is going to die. The greatest human, the greatest leader of all time is no longer there to lead them. And the big question that's going to emerge after this point is what's going to be with the Jewish nation and with the Jewish dream? How will they fare in his absence? They're going to have other great leaders, but history is going to give them their share of challenges. And we're going to see what's going to happen about this more next week.